and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubenstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Hi everyone, I hope that your week is getting off to a great start and I am so looking forward to sharing today's episode with you. Sophie Morgan is a TV presenter, Condé Nast traveler columnist and disability advocate. When she was 18, on the night she received her A-level results, Sophie crashed her car and was left instantly paralysed from the chest down. Everything she had dreamed of for her life was instantly forgotten, and her journey to rediscover herself and build a different life began. I want to go to some extraordinary places, meet some extraordinary people and do some extraordinary things, she wrote from her hospital bed the day she was discharged after her accident. But as a recently injured paraplegic woman, she would go on to face barriers as complex and nuanced as her impairment itself. In her words, when it comes to travel, total satisfaction can be hard, if not impossible, for disabled people to find. She's since made it her mission to right that wrong. Sophie first appeared in BBC Two's show Beyond Boundaries, which followed 11 disabled people on a 220-mile trek across Nicaragua, alongside another previous podcast guest, Amma Latif. After that, her career on TV grew and she became one of the first female wheelchair users globally to host on TV, playing a part in transforming the representation of disability on screen. As the lead presenter on Channel 4's broadcast of the Summer Paralympics, fronting her own primetime travel series and documentaries, as well as being a regular panellist for ITV's Loose Women. She's currently spearheading the global disability rights campaign Rights on Flights, which has taken her to the White House to meet the president. And we talk a lot on today's episode about accessible travel and ableism. It's an issue that has been hugely overlooked in the travel sphere for too long, and hearing Sophie's experiences as a wheelchair user, on planes in particular, but within travel more broadly, really opened my eyes to the significant change that needs to take place to make travel accessible for everyone. Having said that, Sophie has been traveling literally nonstop for the last year. I mentioned it at the start of the episode, all the places and adventures she's been on recently. So not only will today's episode maybe open your eyes to things you might not have thought of before, but it will also fuel your wanderlust for your own future adventures. From Scotland to the US, the French Alps to South Africa and Spain. I really hope you enjoy it. So let's get started. Sophie Morgan, welcome to the Travel Diaries. It is so nice to see you today. It feels like this has been a long time coming. How are you?
Oh, well, firstly, thank you. It's so nice to see you. And yes, it has been a long time coming. I'm good. I'm really well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. And I'm so excited to chat today because since we got this plan in the diary, you have literally travelled the world. Literally. I mean, Chile and Patagonia, mm-hmm. London to Marrakesh by train, a 3-week USA road trip, the White House. I mean, yeah. Where do we get started?
Honestly, I've never known it. It has been, I think, post-COVID, I feel like I've traveled more in these last few years than I have my entire life. It's been extraordinary. I'm really lucky, but yes, kind of tired.
Let's start with the White House, because I mean, looking at your Instagram page, you know, just casual selfies with Joe Biden, as you do, the President of the United States. Tell us about what you've been doing over there, because it's amazing.
Thank you. Well, yeah, it really is surreal. In fact, whenever I look on my Instagram, my grid, it is just sort of still to me quite breathtaking. I can't actually believe there's a selfie there with that man. So the reason for it was because me and my new business partner, Keely Cat-Wells, who like me as a disability advocate, we were invited to the White House because they were celebrating two things. There was the anniversary of the ADA, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is like our Equalities Act or Disability mm-hmm. Discrimination Act, yeah. which is basically the laws that protect disabled Americans. And then the Rehabilitation Act, there was an anniversary for that as well. So the White House put on this big party, really, this big celebration to to mark the anniversaries of these two things, the Rehabilitation Act and the ADA, and invited loads of disability advocates. I think we were the only British ones there. I'm not sure. I didn't get a chance to speak to everybody. But yeah, so we were there just to really kind of pay homage to those who've come before us. I think also, I mean, just to recognize the work that's been done, but also think about the work that is yet to be done and needs to be done. And
yeah, you know, tell us about this, the, you know, accessible transportation laws that you're trying to, that you're working on with them, because you've been essentially advising, right, with the Biden-Harris administration.
Yeah, so what happened was, I mean, advising is probably a bit grandiose, but I'll say a yes, but it's a little bit less than that. So what's been going on is that basically earlier in the year, I'm a wheelchair user. My wheelchair got broken.
Yeah.
My wheelchair got broken by British Airways. And it triggered a campaign. And the campaign is now called Rights on Flights. And it has been a bit of a slog, actually, for the last, I mean, so that was in February. So it's been taking up the best part of this year. And I have just basically been trying to raise awareness of the problems that people like me and others within the disabled community face whenever they fly. And it has led me all over the place, to the Downing Street, to deliver a letter that was asking for greater enforcement powers to the regulators, just to try and protect disabled people a bit more. Then also, yes, over to the White House. So I did actually go to the White House before this last visit with to meet the president, to meet with the transportation secretary, because they're doing a lot of great things in America that we could learn from. I got an invitation to go and sort of find out what was going on. And whilst there, met with so many others who are, like me, working in this space to try and make improvements, whether it's in legislation, in design, and, you know, there's loads of ways in which we can make things better. Yeah. So yeah, I've been kind of all over the place, joining forces with other advocates who have either, like me, had a lived experience of something awful going wrong on an aeroplane, or, you know, or have a family member who has a disability, and so they've got this firsthand experience. But yeah, it's a huge problem, one that we are in this community very aware of, but I worry the wider public isn't so familiar with. So part of the work is raising awareness, and the other part is doing the work to help change it.
Absolutely. I mean, following you and the stories that you've shared about your travel experiences really kind of opened my eyes to issues that I hadn't contemplated that a wheelchair user would face. It just hadn't I hadn't taken the time to think about it. And you've talked about ableist practices on certain airlines, and I just wondered if you could explain to my listeners about kind of ableism, because I know that even you said before you had your accident, you know, it wasn't something that you were especially familiar with either.
Absolutely. And you know what, Holly, I would say, I appreciate you saying that, because I think some non-disabled people feel embarrassed that they don't know the realities of what we're dealing with. But I would always start by saying, I didn't know about them either until I became disabled. And it's been a massive learning curve. So I was paralyzed in a car crash 20 years ago and came face to face then with the you know, the plethora of barriers that people like me face. And one of them is air travel. So I'll tell it from, I'll unpack some of the problems that you face if you're a wheelchair user. But just to say, there are many other ways in which air travel is what we call ableist towards people with disabilities. They're nuanced and they're complex, and there's lots of different problems out there. But for a wheelchair user specifically, the reality is when you arrive at an airport, you never really know what's going to happen next. And it can vary from country to country, from airport to airport. I mean, it's a lottery, and that risk factor is so intimidating, because what happens is you get to the check-in. Typically, you would have had to pre-advise of your access requirements. Now, that's almost the first barrier that you face, because some people who use wheelchairs will not actually be allowed to fly. So their equipment might be deemed, so their batteries, for example, won't be safe, or they carry certain equipment with them, like oxygen, or there's lots of ways in which the airlines can immediately say no. And that is one bug to bear. That's just, I mean, it's unbearable. It's actually, it's pure discrimination. It's plain and simple, but they hide behind the various regulations and safety measures, etc. So it's very frustrating. And a lot of work is being done to try and provide solutions at that very early stage. So if you can,
and does
actually,
that vary from airline to airline? So like, is there a lack of consistency between them as well?
Absolutely.
So that you don't know what to expect in that respect?
That's exactly right. So you can turn up one day, and I've had it. I've turned up once, and I, even though I have been flying with the same equipment, suddenly they said, no, we don't accept this equipment. And I, the battery on my machine was deemed unsafe. And so I was turned away. Mm. You know, it's, and for those listening, they'll go, well, obviously safety is a huge concern. Of course it is. But what you have to understand is the lack of sort of harmonization and consistency makes that really tricky. And the other part is the airlines aren't doing the work, in our experience, from what I've been learning as a campaigner and from lived experience, the airlines aren't doing the work to make sure that there's a way around that. And understanding that there's a human being behind this problem and they need to try and accommodate us. So, so there's those problems at the very, at the outset. Then once you get through security and, you know, the airport itself, which might, it used to not be very accessible, but we're seeing infrastructural changes now, which is helpful. Then it's the whole boarding process. And I have to say that's where it starts to become very inhumane. So someone like me who's unable to walk, at the point where you board the aircraft, your wheelchair basically is taken away from you and put into the hold. Some wheelchairs, if they're small enough, like a manual wheelchair that can be folded and there's room and the aircraft is big enough, they might let you store it in the cabin. But by and large, it's taken down and put into the hold and you are transferred onto this tiny little seat called an aisle chair, which I have to say is really not fit for purpose. It's firstly, if you're able to use your hands, you can't self-propel it. It's designed to be pushed. And so you completely lose your independence and your agency at that point, which is really intimidating.
Yeah.
But even if you aren't able to push, it's very poorly designed. You're sort of strapped in. Picture sort of Hannibal Lecter strapped in with lots of different straps all over you. It's really, really horrible. And then, you know, you get on the plane, you're dragged around the cabin, taken to your seat. And at that point, then you've got to work out, you know, once you're deposited in your seat, either through support or independently, like as in moving yourself across, you know, if you need to go to the loo, you've got to navigate that problem. Some aircrafts don't keep on board one of these small aisle chairs, which means you cannot go to the loo. You cannot move around the cabin. So you might have seen examples in the press of people sort of dragging themselves around cabins or whatever. It's awful. A lot of people starve themselves, dehydrate themselves, myself included. You know, if you know that you're going to be on one of these small planes, you have to factor in going to the loo before and after. But the anxiety,
it's incomprehensible, actually.
I have to say, if I could get through to people and say, look, could you imagine if the loo wasn't working on the plane?
Yeah.
How would you feel?
Exactly.
And people go, oh, well, I wouldn't fly because, you know, and fair enough. You know, and it's this, it's just like, wow, well, this is it anyway. So the last bit is that more often than not, there's damage done to your body. That's one thing, because invariably there will be, because if you do mobilize around the cabin using one of these aisle chairs and try and get into one of these small toilets, they're usually very, very inaccessible. And that's really hard. People have been dropped. People have been hurt. It's really hard. And then lastly, the problem that we do find happening daily is wheelchairs getting damaged, lost, or worst of all, broken. And the impact that has on somebody's lives, I mean, it is the same as having your legs broken.
Yeah, it's
a
lifeline.
You cannot do anything. It's exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot. And on top of that, there's so many other little nuances that I could go into, but you just get the picture.
So there's a lot of work that needs to be done, but it feels like you are heading slowly towards positive changes.
That's right. There is. And there is hope in all of this. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, but there is certainly hope that it will be done. It's just a matter of when. And I keep trying to stress in my campaigning and whenever I'm given the opportunity to talk or somebody's listening, is sort of trying to stress, this is a crisis. In my opinion, in America, I think the stats are 35 or 36, certainly in the 30s, wheelchairs are broken every day. Now, if that was happening to people's legs at the same rate, there'd be an outcry. There would be a boycotting of airlines. The government would step in.
First headline on the news.
You know it. They'd say, God, you know, get your acts together, airlines, otherwise we're going to, whatever, fine you. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's that's not what's happening. People don't see our devices as part of our body, even though they are. Anyway, so yes, there is a lot of work that needs to be done. There is hope on the horizon. There's some fantastic campaigns running. There are some amazing solutions out there, including the option now to potentially, within a row of standard seats, remove some of those seats so that a wheelchair user could potentially travel in their chair should they choose to, for short haul or long haul, which is one step forward. But at the same time, if you don't have accessible toilets, think about if you were on a train and you've got that space for a wheelchair user, as we all see, that sort of space would be ideal on an aeroplane.
Yes.
But it only works if there's a disabled toilet that you can actually access as well. Yeah. So, you know, it's baby steps, but certainly things are moving. It's just glacial pace.
And I mean, despite all of those potentially traumatic hurdles that you face traveling, as you said, this has been one of the most busy years for you.
Yeah.
And I am really looking forward to going through your seven chapters of your travel diaries today, because you've traveled to such interesting locations and obviously you have so many interesting and important stories to tell. So we're going to start at the very beginning of your life. Chapter one is your earliest childhood travel memory.
So I think the earliest, my memory is shocking. It's awful and I hate it. So I'm always trying to encourage my parents to drag out pictures, because I just, so much of my childhood is a blur to me.
Is that because of your accident, do you think?
Or? I have been told there could be something to do with that. Yeah, but I'm not sure. Mm. But certainly the earliest memory I have of going away is being bundled into the back of my parents' car with my little brother and wrapping ourselves up in our duvets and driving out to France to go to the Alps. Mm. And my dad was a brilliant skier, still is.
Yeah.
And he taught me and my little brother to ski. So we would go to, I mean, I couldn't tell you the names of the places that we went. I just remember driving up those wonderful hairpin roads that snake all the way up into the Alps. I remember, I mean, the blur between the, you know, the Channel Tunnel and all of the kind of the middle parts of France I can't recall that, but just the snaking up into the mountains and then being in the snow and then just, yeah. Oh, I loved that. I loved that so much. It was such a privilege being able to do that with my little family. I loved it.
And I mean, like you're saying how much then, you know, you loved the skiing. I mean, you've described yourself as, you know, always being a very free spirit. Mm. And travel was important to you from a young age.
I loved it so much. I honestly had this bug for it, and I was always sort of slightly unsatiated, I think, all of my teens. So those little memories there of skiing, you know, pre-teen, in my teenage years, I didn't travel as much. We would drive out to the Alps as often as we could. But as a family, we didn't really do many other kind of holidays. And then as I got into my teens and started to think about where I wanted to try and get myself to, I didn't have any money. So it was like, you know, the dreams were big, but the realities were just sort of not so exciting. But I did have this feeling that travel was where I needed to sort of spend my time. You know, I wanted to kind of explore all the time. I loved that process of, I suppose that it started young, being bundled up into something and just transported into another world. I loved it.
Yeah, yeah, the excitement of it. It's,
yeah.
The thing about, it's so interesting with all my guests, I feel like so many of their earliest childhood travel memories are actually less about the destination and more about that journey of getting up early in the morning and getting into car, packing into the car, the kind of the yes. little snack you might have packed, or
yes.
you know, the excitement as, you know, you're all getting ready in the dark, or, and it's so funny, isn't it? It's when you're little, it's the journey and the build up, the anticipation.
Oh, you're so right. It's the feeling. It's almost like the pre-Christmas feeling or something.
Yeah,
it's like that Christmas Eve feel and the vibe of just you know the pure excitement of something new. And I think that's so addictive, and just that, oh, where now? What are we doing next? Where are we going?
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, on the night of your A-level results party, everything changed.
Mm-hmm.
You've said that in that instant, your dreams were pushed to one side and you had to let them go, but what you couldn't let go of was your desire to see the world.
Yeah, so absolutely, just it was, I felt so robbed of this life I had imagined for myself, and I felt so close to it, you know. So yes, I had my, that was the day, the injury happened on the day that I got my A-level results. And if you think about the significance of that time, I think for anybody, certainly UK listeners, that, you know, the summer of your A-level results,
yeah,
it's so heady and exciting, and you're thinking about what's next, and you're, I was sort of in that, you know, in that precipice, I call it, of kind of just leaving childhood and falling into adult life. And I felt very much like that adult life looked like an adventure. And I was so in my mind ready to go and explore and be in the world free. And I, that word free kept coming back to me all the time. And I, it's in my, all of my diaries. I'm always going on about how I want to feel free. And what that meant was putting on a backpack and traveling somewhere. I thought, I mean, I wasn't actually going to do, you know, massive travel. I hadn't planned any massive trips or anything like that. I just knew that's what I wanted to try and do at some point. I was actually planning to go into higher education and do a degree and stuff. But I just knew that travel was going to be this huge part of my life. And then I had this car accident and a spinal injury, and everything changed, because the concept of travel was then utterly redefined and completely unobtainable, it felt, I think, to begin with. And yeah.
Because I guess it was also a long journey of rehabilitation to like, compared to, you know, your strength and fitness now.
Yeah, there was a lot that I had to regain. And it wasn't just about, so to be clear, there was no regaining of the function of my body, because once I was paralyzed, it was instant and it was complete and it was irreversible. So from the level of my chest down, everything I lost, in all of the movement, all of the sensation, everything that was gone was never coming back. But the rehabilitation process was very much about me adapting to life with that disability and finding ways to regain a life, and certainly a life worth living. And I grasped that kind of, you know, I was so determined to refine my life, but I had to do it within this context of, you know, disability and as a wheelchair user, what that meant was unknowable. I didn't have a clue what that looked like. So it was the beginning of a very, very difficult journey 20 years ago.
Yeah, because you just marked it, of course, the with your journey the US. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh my God.
What was it that you were traveling on? What would you call that vehicle?
So it's called a Can-Am Spider. So Can-Am is a brand, more fit for people in the States will have heard of it and seen far more of them than you do in the UK. But yeah, Can-Am is the brand, and the vehicle that I did the ride on is called a Spider. So it looks like, for anyone who's not familiar, it's two wheels on the front and one wheel on the back. So it's like a trike, but it is just, oh my God, it's so much fun. And it's just pure freedom for me. I mean, so I basically, I wanted to ride London to LA, but I didn't have enough time to get from London all the way around sort of and go. I just, the routes were looking a bit tricky. And so in the end, I decided to just fly from London to the East Coast of the States and pick up the Spider in DC, and then ride across the whole of the US to get into LA on the day that my injury, the anniversary of my injury. So that's the 18th of August. So I set off around the 1st. So I didn't give myself a huge amount of time, to be honest.
So 3 weeks or so, was it?
Exactly, yeah. Just under. So it was a really massive mission, but it was so much fun.
A lot of ground to cover.
It was so much fun.
And what was your highlight?
Oh, honestly, I will never get over Jackson and the Grand Tetons, the just south of Yellowstone.
In Wyoming.
I've never seen anything like it in my life. Yellowstone itself was, amazing. Mm. But we weren't blessed with very good weather, unfortunately. We'd been in the rain from around near where Mount Rushmore is, the Black Hills, which, oh gosh, they were beautiful, but really, really, really bad weather and bad visibility, which was made the whole riding experience pretty tough. And that continued all the way into Yellowstone. So that was a bit of an anticlimax because I've been so excited about seeing that. However, we did do some wolf tracking in Yellowstone, in northeast Yellowstone, which was mind-blowing. So a tiny little wolf pup, which was awesome.
Today's episode is supported by Dr. David Jack. In a world of confusing skincare routines, overwhelming product options, and endless TikTok skincare hacks, Dr. David Jack has arrived to revolutionize your skincare journey. Welcome to the era of healthy, happy, and rejuvenated skin with Dr. David Jack's streamlined approach. So a bit about Dr. Jack. He's a leading aesthetic doctor with an NHS background in plastic surgery, and he has award-winning clinics in London's Harley Street and Belgravia. He's witnessed the skincare struggle firsthand, how overwhelming it can be, but he is here to change the game, and I can speak with experience because I've been using his products for the last few weeks and I'm already noticing such a tangible change, not only in its appearance, but also in my own experience, because at the heart of his revolutionary skincare line is the Daily Skin Trio. This is a capsule collection that is about to become your skincare soulmate. Three products, three simple steps. Waking up to radiant skin with a powerhouse vitamin C morning serum, protecting your skin with a nourishing SPF day moisturizer, and then gently replenishing with a regenerating retinoid night cream. Three steps, all your skincare needs from day to night. So, are you ready to embark on a streamlined journey to true skin health? Get rid of all that confusion. Just focus on these three things that you need on your shelf, these three amazing products. The Daily Skin Trio. You'll be pleased to hear I have got an exclusive discount code for you to use when purchasing. Just use the code SKINJOURNEY15 at checkout. That's SKINJOURNEY15 at checkout. Thank you to Dr. David Jack.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
I think as a Brit traveling through America, I felt this sense of, I don't know how to describe it, the scale of that place in contrast to what we're used to. It's actually impossible to get my head around. I mean, I remember riding into Idaho and it's just, I just, there were these roads that would go on forever, Holly. And I just was, you know, it felt like I was, I think we drove, I don't know how many UKs fit into our journey, but I'd say, you know, probably at least six, the route we went. And you just think it's like the UK is so small. And until you get out into these huge, vast places and start to see
But that's the beauty of slow travel as well, because you're getting the context of that because you're actually crossing on the ground as opposed to just flying from spot to spot.
Absolutely. You get that sense of the insignificance of us as these tiny little human beings and this epic world. And I love that too. I wish I'd had longer, but it's just I had work kind of on either side. So I had deadlines and things. But if I could, I would have taken, you know, a lifetime over that journey. You could spend so much time exploring all the national parks. They're absolutely, mind-blowing.
Yeah, some of my favourite places in the world as well. Well, let's move on now to chapter two. And that is the first place you fell in love with.
The first place I fell in love with was the south of France. My family used to... So we had some very good family friends who lived down in the south of France in a small little village called Cotignac, which is in the Var, which is it's about an hour and a half northwest of Nice and an equidistant actually from Marseille. So up in the hills of Provence. And these family friends, they lived there. And I used to go down and stay with the daughter. And I just loved it there. It was just, oh my gosh, so gorgeous. I loved it. And my family would come down too. And as a family, we all fell in love with this area. And we just kept fantasizing about the idea of also having a house there, like our friends did. And it was just this ongoing fantasy throughout my entire childhood. And actually, when I had my injury, not long after, my dad just said, you know what? Life's so short. We should get a place there. We should find a way. And we did in the end. He bought this land and it was amazing. The story, it's long, but he bought some land down in this area and over the course of about a decade, slowly built a house there. And we built it all accessible. So we designed it together as a family. And yeah, honestly, that place for us is a second home now. And I just love it so much. I mean, the French villages and the countryside, the vineyards, the whole thing is just
the
wonderful.
Light there. Is yeah, so beautiful.
Don't get me started on the light. Everyone always tells me to stop talking about the light.
Really? You love
honestly,
the light,
dear. I love the light.
Oh yeah, because you're an amazing painter.
And I used to go down there when I had more time on my hands before my life got so busy, I used to go down there for summers and I'd kind of just go there and paint. And I just, that was a life. That was amazing.
And what a kind of a healing place for you.
100%. It was where I fixed myself. And I think it also brought my family together as well. We congregated there after my injury and had good times, you know, and after all the trauma and all the sadness and all of the upheaval of my injury and then, you know, everything. It was where we used to go and drink wine and sit in the sun and listen to the crickets and escape. Yeah. It was very, very healing place.
That
and
sounds
still is.
Magical. Yeah. I'm so happy for you that it's like that you're still getting to go there as well.
Absolutely. Although that chapter has now closed somewhat and I leave it in the past because I'm actually thinking about moving to America. In fact, I kind of am. So I'll tell you about that later. But that's that part of the world. Anyone who knows it knows what I mean. There's something in the air. And there's certainly something in the light, but there's something in the air. It's just
pure magic. Well, chapter three is a place where you learned the most about yourself. Where would that be?
Without a shadow of a doubt, it's Scotland. I went to Scotland so my mum is part Scottish. Yeah, my grandfather is Scottish from the borders. But they grew up, he moved out of Scotland when she was young and she grew up in England. So she's always had this kind of fascination with Scotland because of her dad. I never met him, but I inherited her fascination, certainly, because she would talk about it so fondly. Anyway, we never went there as a family. But when I was about in my early teens, I got in quite a lot of trouble. I was being quite a difficult little kid and I got kicked out of school. And then my mom was like, I think I'm going to send you to school in Scotland. So she and my dad, bless them, They did. And they sent me up to Scotland. And I thought I was, I mean, I had no idea what to expect, but I certainly wasn't feeling good about it, to be honest with you.
Despite the fascination.
Despite the fascination, I was very much like, oh, what am I doing? But that was that. It was a kind of punishment because I'd been so badly behaved. And off I went to Scotland and completely and utterly fell in love with it. And I spent the next 5 years there. So most of my teenage years there.
In what part of Scotland was it?
So it's up in Murrayshire. So mm-hmm. on the coast, the Murrayshire coast.
Yeah.
Near Nairn, in Elgin, near Elgin. So up in there. Yeah. Yeah, it's like a... It's
landscape like my husband's family live in Edinburgh, so we've traveled a little bit in Scotland as well, and it is it's one of those places that you it's one of those places where you would go on a plane journey, I feel, for like 18 hours to see something like that, and it's actually just an hour away on a plane, or you know,
you've summed it up perfectly. I think sometimes there was moments where you just forget that you were it is another planet in the best way possible. It's so beautiful and so rugged and raw and real. And I loved it. I mean, exploring Scotland, I could just do that for the rest of my life if I could. It was just wonderful.
So for people who haven't been, where would you, for the places that, you know, you loved there, where would you recommend to visit?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, where I spent the most time was pretty spectacular. Places like Findhorn and that coastline, the Murrayshire coast, really beautiful, but also the west coast of Scotland, some of the inner and outer Hebrides, if you can get to there, wow, go. It's just, again, there's something about, I'm trying to find the word and I'm struggling, but it is spiritual. There's, you leave Scotland feeling very different to when you arrived. And, yeah, it just puts you in your place again. You know what? Something I suppose I could equate it to some of the ways I felt when I was in those national parks in America. Mm. It just feels quite untouched and quite unspoiled and as it once was and as it should be. And it's just, there's also this sparsity. There's no one around, and certainly up in the Highlands and further north, and then over to the West Coast. I'm not as familiar with the South and the, you know, that parts of those parts of Scotland, but certainly they're just as beautiful.
Yeah.
So it was
a place of real growth for you.
Yes, 100%. It's where I, you know, grew up. I spent my teens there and fell in love there. And I learned about myself there. And I think it was the foundation for a lot, but unfortunately that's where I had my injury. So that's where I crashed my car and that's where I was paralyzed. So there's a lot of history there for me. There's a huge amount of nostalgia connected with it. And so in some respects, it's like a home for me, a second home, but in a very, at times, painful way, because it's where I walked. It's where I climbed and run around in the mud and, you know, even went skiing. Oh, gosh, there's brilliant skiing, you know. Well, brilliant's a bit strong. But there's skiing. And I did all of that as a kid, and I had such a privileged, wonderful life. And then, yes, now as a wheelchair user, it's hard to go back because I look at a lot of the landscape and it feels inaccessible to me. Whereas once before that felt like my oyster. I could just do with it whatever I wanted. I could, you know, camp in it and just do whatever I wanted in that landscape. But now, not so much. So it's a special but difficult place for me to think about.
You were saying how you could draw comparisons with a lot of the wildness of Scotland to the US national parks, and you know, having then just experienced a lot on your trip in America and your travels, you know, what national parks or wild spaces have you found particularly did embrace you and cater to your needs?
It's a really great question. And actually, it's the reason why I want to move to America, is because the national parks there and actually much of the outdoors in America, I have found to accommodate people like me, wheelchair users, disabled people, much, much more than anywhere else. And I think I suppose I've really been on a two-decade, 20-year-long mission to find accessible spaces. And the more I travel in America, the more time I spend there, the more I explore and research, the greater it feels to me that there is this attitude around inclusion that I don't get anywhere else. And so The national parks, say, for example, I mean, Yosemite, I went into Sequoia with the beautiful sequoia trees, and up by the redwoods. And I don't know, there was something about everywhere I went, there are paths, but just the way it's configured, it feels like you can experience it too. Whether that's on a bike, whether that's in a wheelchair, whether that's in a car, whether that's on foot, it just feels inclusive somehow. And I don't get that sense in Scotland. And I think that's why I have been searching for it. And I'm so looking forward to exploring more, because I think the more I get, you know, even places like the Grand Canyon now, I've heard they've started opening up trails to make it more accessible. And there's just moves in the right direction that enable people like me to feel that equality of experience.
Yeah.
You're not just sitting on the side looking in, you're in.
Yeah.
And that feels really important to me. And I'm again searching for it all the time.
I'm excited for you for your new chapter. I mean, let's put a chapter 3.5 of the Travel Diaries. Where are you moving to? Like, what's next, do you think?
California.
My dream.
Is it your dream?
Yeah, totally. I got married in California. I'm an American citizen, actually. So
It's
somewhere that I, you know, expect to live at some point.
Yes. We're kindred spirits.
Yeah.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
So what part? Which are you going to pick?
This is the problem. I've always had it, just like you said, I've always feel like I was going to live there at some point. I just didn't know when. And then I spent a lot of time there before this bike trip. I was there in January. I was there last year. I keep going back there for various work opportunities or something. And I just was like, you know what? I need to move here. I love who I am here. I'm not as disabled here. I feel really free here. And I call it the land of the step free, because it is just so like the laws that are in place to protect the laws that took me to the White House. I'm circling back. The reason I was in the White House in the first place was celebrating the ADA, right? The Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA around America, in my experience, is far, far more enforced than any of the laws that we have in the UK. And I mean, there's pros and cons to everywhere you go as a disabled person. And I'm not going to say it's the best, but in my experience, those laws in California mean that I think people like me can just go places without having to worry so much. You can plan your life the same as anyone else. You know, I can, for example, go meet friends and I don't have to worry about, is there going to be a loo there? You know, that's been my life for the last 20 years. Or actually, do you know what? I'm not going to come because I don't think I'm going to get in, and I don't want to bother you guys because it's just a pain. You know, that sense of I've always been othered, and I've normalized that for a long time. So yes, California is where I want to go first. And at the moment it's going to be in LA. But I'm exploring California every weekend that I'm there, going all around. I've explored north, south, east, west. I love it.
It's amazing. Love it.
Oh, I love it.
I'm about to actually, in a couple of episodes prior to this, so it will already be out, but I'm doing a California destination special this series.
Oh, you're serious? Yeah. Oh my gosh. I have to tune in. Okay.
I will send you the link.
You must, yes.
I love Santa Barbara.
One
of my favorite places.
That's amazing.
Well, I mean, chapter 4 is your all-time favorite destination. I mean, it sounds like California's up there.
It might well be, I'm struggling now to find places that top it, because of course there's so much of it that it's so different. And you've got the desert, you've got, you know, the mountains, you've got the beach, you've got the wine country, you've got like, there's so much to explore. And every time I go out and explore another part of it, I'm like, oh, I want to live here. Oh, no, hold on. I want to live here. Oh, no, here. And I just love it. I also have to say, aside from the geography of it, which is stunning, it's also the people. I really like, maybe it's an American thing in general. I've always found that kind of really positive outlook there.
Sunny
really.
Outlook.
Well, somebody said to me, you can't be, how do they word it? It was brilliant. They said, you can't have a sunny disposition if it's not sunny. And I was like, that's so brilliant.
So true.
And so out there, that whole have a great day, I'm like, thank you. I will. You too. You know, here yeah. you're like, you're right. Yeah, not bad.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's so I think is fine. And I'm sure there'll be a moment where I'll go, oh God, I'm too British for this place. I need some sarcasm and dry humor. But at the same time, I think I've had enough of feeling kind of slightly pessimistic here. There's a pessimistic outlook at times and it's contagious. I'm really leaning into that kind of, yeah, pseudo sort of happy that you get out there and I want to be around it. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Oh, yeah. Wonderful. I can't wait to follow like what you're going to do next.
Wish
out
me
there.
Luck. Thanks.
We've touched on this already, but your experience traveling as a wheelchair user must have changed so much in the time that since your injury. And your Condé Nast Traveler magazine column Beyond Barriers really focuses on, you know, the steps forward with accessible travel and new places that are exciting that I imagine you'll be shining a light on coming up. But are there any destinations or hotels that you really feel like are specifically worth a mention?
I'd say one of the places that I still am not over really was Shimuwu, which is a luxury accessible safari lodge South Africa.
I saw that on your Instagram. Oh my gosh.
It's a fascinating place. It's a private resort that was created by a Dutch couple, Ellie and Patrick. And Patrick had an experience and Patrick was in a wheelchair for a while. And it just opened his eyes up to the problems that we face. And it made him question, you know, how do you do safari when you're a wheelchair user? And that's just opened up a can of worms. And so he's completely designed from the ground up, because he owned this private land in South Africa, just south of the Kruger National Park. He designed this fully inclusive destination, a private resort. And then, yeah, just was like, I want to make it very luxury, because I don't see why disabled people have to compromise on luxury.
Yeah.
So he went all in. And honestly, if you get a second, anyone who's listening to this and you want to see it, just have a look on my Instagram at some of the things that they've created, because the little modifications that Patrick has made to sort of the safari jeeps or to the resort itself, just to make it seamless and inclusive, are just fascinating. And of course, safari, the experience of safari.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, yeah.
Beyond the adaptations, the fact that you can experience something so magical is just so wonderful.
And also, I think that feeling of like that world could feel like it's inaccessible to you. Obviously, financially, sure, but also physically. And it just feels very much like, oh, I can't do that stuff now if you have a disability or... You know, or if you travel with somebody who might have a mobility impairment of any kind, I don't know, it just feels like it's not fully, it might not be on your bucket list, but thanks to these guys, it certainly can be on your bucket list.
Oh, so do you think that, are you hearing if there will be similar changes, you know, integrated into other hotels in the area?
Yeah, I couldn't speak for more of that particular area, but certainly across the world, every day I'm getting approached by people who are either looking to become more accessible or have done the work and want aid, or maybe to be featured in the column or to, you know, be invited, or if I'm really lucky, invite me out to go and experience it and talk about it. And I'm seeing more and more disabled, I'm not an influencer, but disabled influencers going out and being invited to places that are doing the work, and people go, look, we've done it. We've made steps. We've made changes.
That's brilliant.
And that's really encouraging. So I can't help but feel that the inclusive travel, accessible travel is sort of one step behind sustainable travel in the mission of the industry, the travel industry, to be better. And I'm hoping that we can, you know, obviously no one is more important than the other, but certainly we can try and position our mission or our objectives and our, you know, and align them with what's happened with sustainability. as accessibility.
That's exciting. Yeah. Well, chapter 5 is your hidden gem. Sophie, that is a place that you love that maybe my listeners don't know so much about. What would you pick? What can you share with us?
I think I'm going to say, well, you wouldn't really classify it as hidden, but Seville. I went there recently and I'd never been and I loved it. I was part of a plane-free trip to go from the UK to Morocco. And we went by train via Paris, Barcelona, Madrid, Seville, all the way down, blah, 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 into Morocco.
Amazing.
Over
route.
A week. Yeah, it was brilliant. It was to sort of demonstrate you can travel these routes without taking an aeroplane and how much better that is for the world, but also how much more accessible it is if you are someone who can't fly. On the journey, we stopped in Seville and I just fell in love with it like that. It was so stunning. The architecture, the food, the vibe, the culture. We went to see flamenco and honestly, my mouth was just like, I couldn't shut my mouth for like half an hour. I loved it. It was so good. And yeah, I think I want to go back there. So that was not a hidden gem, but certainly for me, it was a new discovery.
A gem, a real special place. It is such a great, it's got, again, a very special air about it, I think. Mm-hmm. That's something, well, I guess it's so hot, isn't it? And it feels, it's a great city and a great recommendation and so easily accessible.
Yeah.
By plane or by train. And
absolutely.
And I'm interested to know your experience of the European trains getting down there. How was that?
Honestly, brilliant.
Oh, amazing.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So good.
Because the trains in the UK especially for wheelchair users, but you know, they're expensive, they're difficult, they're not as enjoyable. I would say they're not enjoyable. I don't know. I've not had an enjoyable train journey, but I definitely had an enjoyable journey going over to France and then down through France into Spain, across Spain. I mean, the Eurostar is so easy and accessible. But the trains that run down through France, gorgeous scenery, just sit there and relax and watch the world go by. And before you know it, you're in Barcelona as well. You know, that's like, really recommend it. Really
Brilliant.
Recommend it.
Mm. Well, our penultimate chapter, Sophie, is chapter 6. And that is your worst travel experience or the place that you would never go back to.
When I was about a year post my injury, so I was 19 years old and I'd only been paralyzed a very short time at that point. And I thought I knew it all, A, because I was 19, but B, because I had made a lot of improvements. Like I had learned a lot about how to live with a disability quite quickly. And I was feeling really super independent and brave and great. And, you know, I'd learned to drive again. And I was at that point, I just enrolled in art college and I was, you know, stepping out. And, you know, I felt very, very brave and independent as a wheelchair user. And I got this invitation from the BBC to go on an expedition across Nicaragua on foot. Obviously as a wheelchair user, but on foot, to go from the West Coast to the East Coast. And it was going to take place over about a month with 11 other disabled people, all to be televised. And I thought that was a great idea. I thought, I'm going to do that. So I signed up, I auditioned, I got this position. And off I found myself flying to the Mosquito Coast in a massive army aeroplane, like in the hangar of this enormous army aeroplane with all the crew, cameras, with all these other contributors as well, with various different disabilities.
Yeah, because Amer Latif, who was on last season, he was on that series, right?
Exactly. That's where we met. I love him.
Yeah, me too.
He became very much like my legs when I was there. He did a lot of pushing and I did a lot of guiding. Yeah, we would work in together. So he would stand behind my chair and I would be his eyes and he would do my pushing. And so we had this little routine, you know, of us going through the jungle. But I have to say it was really hard because I hadn't quite realized then, it sounds naive perhaps now, but I then hadn't realized how disabled I was because I hadn't been out of and put myself into an environment that really, really disabled me. And being in the jungle as a disabled girl with very little upper body strength in a wheelchair that really couldn't get across the terrain, I was absolutely paralyzed. You know, I felt as paralyzed as I had ever felt before. And it was really hard for me. On top of that, all the weather and, you know, the heat and the mosquitoes and the conditions were extreme and it was very hard. And I had a mental breakdown really. And then I got amoebic dysentery and was sort of evacuated. It was awful.
Oh my gosh.
So I wouldn't go back there.
No, I could understand that. I imagine that it was a kind of moment of growth on reflection though.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Without a shadow of a doubt, as they say, post-traumatic growth. It was very much the case of I learned a huge amount about myself, but also about my disability and that's okay. It was, you know, it was a learning of what I couldn't do, but it made me even more grateful and have more drive to find the things that I could do. So that's why, you know, I said it earlier, the perpetual search for finding accessible spaces matters to me. And you know, I don't put myself into environments that will make me feel disabled, really, because it's just, there's no joy in it for me anymore.
Yeah.
So it was a learning curve for sure.
Oh, Sophia, I've so enjoyed chatting to you and hearing your travel diaries. It's been such a pleasure. Chapter 7 is our final chapter, and that is the destination that's at the top of your travel bucket list.
Oh, so hard, this, Holly. Because you know why this is hard? Because every single year this list gets adapted because more and more places become accessible. So, because normally, you know, if you don't have a disability or whatever, money is no object, you can pick any list. You can curate any kind of list. But for me, for so long, this list has been so limited, but it's getting bigger and bigger every day. So I really struggle with this question, but I think it's the Antarctic. I'd like to see whether I experience it on a boat or I don't know how to experience it in an accessible way, but it's there. I just want to be there. I want to see it. I want to be in amongst it. That's where I want to go. Yeah. Really. There, yeah, I think that's where I'd go.
Brilliant. Oh, I hope that you make it there very, very soon. Sophie Morgan, those were your travel diaries. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, a massive thank you to Sophie for joining me on the podcast, finding time in her hugely busy schedule. I so appreciate it. And I really hope you found it as interesting and informative as I did. It certainly made me look at travel through a different lens. You can read Sophie's Condé Nast Traveler column, Beyond Barriers, in magazines and online now. Thanks so much for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to press follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you want to be the first to find out who is joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein, and you'll also find me on Threads and TikTok. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait until next week, remember, there's the first 9 seasons to catch up on. That's over 100 episodes to keep you busy there. Don't forget that all the destinations mentioned by my guests are included in the episode show notes here on your podcast app and listed on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks again, everyone. Take care, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.